polite and simple talk, very simple-minded. It's just, so to speak, a joint remark with Thomas Kappeler from University of Zurich. So what is it about? Well, I mean, the KdV equation was presented here now several times already, and I think I should assume that you all know what it's about. I mean, this is a KdV equation up there. Is that a pointer? No. Do we have a pointer somewhere? This? Oh, it's not. Yeah, but I don't see it. But anyway, doesn't. Okay. And how does it work? You just push the button, eh? Yeah, okay. So, well, we look at KdV with periodic boundary conditions, so period one solutions of the KdV equation. And it's a well-known fact that this is an infinite dimensional integrable Hamiltonian system. So we are talking about Hamiltonian systems again. And the KdV Hamiltonian is integral of 1 half ux squared plus u cubed. And you can look at this on any of the standard Sobolev spaces Hn, n greater or equal to 1. And if you introduce the Poisson bracket by Gardner, then this equation has a Hamiltonian structure ut is equal to ddx of d del h del u, and you get the same KdV equation. So this is the setting, and so I can put that over here. So this is the equation we want to consider as an evolution equation for u with period 1. And the question we want to address is the well-posedness of the KdV equation. So that means if you're giving some initial value, u naught, in some subspace H of H1, we'll talk about that later, what spaces these are, then you're posing the question if there is a unique solution curve with this initial value, phi t of u naught, staying in that special subspace script H of H1. So a curve with initial value u naught. And you can ask this question locally, that is, you want a solution curve on a finite time interval, or you can also ask this globally for t in all r. So, putting it a little bit more specifically, you are asking, for example, whether you find a continuous map from the real line in the global case into that subspace H you singled out for your purposes, giving rise to a solution of this KdV equation. Also, if you want to call this problem well posed, you would like to have some reasonable dependence on initial values u naught. So you could phrase this question in the following form. You look at the map from the initial value u naught into the solution curve, say in the space of continuous maps from R into H. And so this gives you a map from H into the space of continuous curves like that. And then you would like that this map has some nice regularities, say at least continuous or differentiable or something like that. So that would be the question of well-posedness of the KdV equation in any sort of subspace H you can think of in H1. Now, this question has a long history, and I don't want to repeat it, as there are certainly many people here who know this history much better than I do. So the first results, as far as I know, go back to Temam about in 69. He showed this local well-posedness problem holds, or well-posedness property holds in H2. And in 76, Saud and Temam did this for HS, S greater or equal than 2, also locally on a finite time interval. And then one other big result was from Bergin by 1992, he found that the well-posedness is given globally in the Sobolev spaces HS. So that's, so to speak, the classical history of this question. So what is the next slide? Now, as the title said, I now want to address this question for other types of subspaces H of H1, namely, oh, it's a little bit weighted Sobolev spaces, which are very simply defined, as the name suggests, by weights. Weights is just the map from the integers to the real numbers, having these three properties of being normalized, symmetric, and submultiplicative. So at zero, you just assume the value is 1, W of minus n is equal to W of n, and it's submultiplicative that W of n plus m is less or equal than W of n times W of m. And then if you write down the Fourier theory expansion of the function u, then you just define the norm in the usual way by throwing these weights onto the Fourier coefficients, and this gives you the weighted norm. And you then look at the space HW of all functions u in L2 period, such that this norm, weighted norm, is finite. So the three probably most relevant cases of weights are, first, the case where you recover the Sobolev spaces, so the weights are just powers of n, roughly speaking, n to the r, and you just add the 1 so that at 0 you also get a non-zero weight. Second, you have these so-called Abel Sobolev spaces, which are just exponential weights plus a polynomial factor. With r greater to equal greater than 0, these give rise to spaces, call them HRA, which consists of functions that are analytic, of course, of period 1, analytic in a strip of width A, and if you look at the trace of these functions on the boundary of this strip, this trace should be functions in the Sobolev spaces HR. And in between these two spaces are these Jeffrey spaces, which you obtain by weights which don't grow exactly like exponential functions of n, but with a smaller power of n, some power n to the sigma, with sigma between 0 and 1. Let's call them Jeffrey spaces HR A sigma. And these are just special cases of or classes of C infinity functions. Well, maybe you have any other weights which are of particular interest to you. Maybe probably they will also fit into that framework. But these are the three most relevant cases to just to have in mind when I talk about the well-posedness problem. And of course, I mean, the Sobolev case is done, more or less, and my focus will be on the Jeffrey case and a little bit also on the Abel-Sobolev case. So it's for these spaces that I want to present results about the well-posedness of the KdV equation. And so this is the main result. That the periodic KdV is globally well-posed in the Sobolev spaces. That's the classical well-known result so far. And in the Jeffrey spaces HRA sigma. Any of these Jeffrey spaces, the periodic KdV is globally well-posed. If you look at the Abel-Sobolev spaces, that is, spaces of analytic functions, the result is not exactly true in that fashion, but you have to modify it a little bit. Say you can say it's almost well-posed in the Abel-Sobolev spaces, meaning that you don't, if you start with an initial value in the class HRA, meaning it's analytic in a strip of width A, and you just follow the evolution of this initial value, you cannot guarantee that along the flow curve all the functions you obtain are again analytic in the same strip of the same width. You have to allow for a little loss in the strip width, but at least you can find an alpha smaller than A but bigger than zero, so that uniformly the whole curve consists of analytic functions which are analytic in the fixed strip alpha. I mean, at least you can guarantee that the strip width doesn't go to zero as time goes to infinity. It stays away from zero. And, well, I will talk about that later a little bit more. And you can even choose this alpha uniformly for initial values in some bounded subset of that space. So, yeah, that's what it means. It stays in that. Staying in that space means that this corresponding norm remains bounded. Yes. You stay in a fixed ball. Yes, of course. Yes. I mean, when you will see the idea of proof, it's nothing, actually. Yes, but Jeffrey is even simpler. I mean, with Jeffrey, you don't have this little nuisance of giving up a little bit of analyticity. So, well, a few remarks here. Same results work for higher KDV. It's not just the first KDV, but, I mean, there's no difference between first and higher order KDV equation. And it's also meaningful and interesting to apply this not only for the KDV equation itself, but also for perturbations, Hamiltonian perturbations of the KDV equation. I will describe that a little bit later. Oh. Yes. Yeah, yeah, these things are somewhat independent, these two parameters in this spaces. Okay, so so that's the main result. And now the essence of the proof, I mean, the basic idea of the proof is really very, very simple when you think about it. You just have to recall, and who said this? This morning also? Percy, huh? I mean, you have to recall that the KDV flow is an isospectral deformation of the periodic Schrödinger operator, or Hill's equation. So if you look at this equation, and you look at the potential Q, and you consider Q as the initial value and let it flow along the KDV flow, you get a curve of potentials, and for all the potentials, this periodic spectrum stays the same. So the spectrum with periodic boundary conditions is invariant along the flow of the KDV equation. So now you just have to recall, or I mean, make this argument like this, that if you look at an initial value in your special subspace HW, then this determines, or let's put it like this, if you look at the initial value and look at this periodic spectrum, then the regularity of the initial value is reflected in the asymptotics of the spectral gaps. The spectral gaps are the length of the gaps lambda n plus minus lambda n minus. So think of the spectral gaps as more or less like the Fourier coefficients of a periodic function. I mean, this is, you can make this analogy really precise, and it's really legitimate to think about it that way. So if you start in a certain class of regularity, then this regularity is reflected in the spectral asymptotics of the initial value. Now, if you flow along the KDV flow, the spectrum stays the same. So the spectral asymptotics for the flow point phi t of U0 on the curve is exactly the same because nothing moves. So if you can make the same argument backwards, going from the spectral asymptotics of the gaps to the regularity of the corresponding potential, you should recover the same regularity. So phi t of U0 should also be in HW, and this is just the well-posedness. You should stay in the same space. You don't gain anything, you don't lose anything, everything stays the same. That's essentially the argument. Now, to put this argument on, say, safe ground, you have to do a little bit, and then you just have to make use of the big gun, so to speak. I mean, it's just one big theorem you have to use, and the rest is just more or less hand-waving. We have nothing more to do. And this big gun is these Birkhoff coordinates, which were introduced by Thomas Kappler, and which we together described in the recent book, which means roughly the following. You introduce a space of sequences, namely Birkhoff coordinates, x and yn, and put on this space, well, first just Sobolev weights. Call the norm the R norm if you put the weight n to the R, roughly speaking, on the coordinates. Then the main theorem about integrability of the KDV equation, oops, is the following. If you look at this equation, then you can introduce coordinates in the following way. You can define a real analytic symplectic diffeomorphism from the sequence space, the coordinate space of Birkhoff coordinates, into L2, so that's even larger than what you need for KdV, such that this map is first of all onto. Second, its restriction to spaces of the higher regularity of sequences with faster decay rate maps the space Hn plus 1/2 into the corresponding Sobolev space, capital script H of n, also onto, 1 to 1 and onto. And secondly, I mean, that's the main feature of the thing, of course, is that the KdV Hamiltonian, when transformed into this space of sequences, becomes a function of the actions alone. So it really introduces action angle coordinates, but not explicit action angle coordinates I theta, but in the form of Birkhoff coordinates. So you know the Hamiltonian of the KdV equation becomes a function of xn squared plus yn squared. And the whole thing is real analytic, and the inverse is also real analytic diffeomorphism, so everything is nice and simple. You really get one global coordinate system which simplifies your KdV equation and writes it as a classical integrable Hamiltonian system with infinitely many coordinates xn, yn. A few remarks. L to 0 means I look at the functions with mean value 0, because this is a trivial degree of freedom in the KdV equation, which we just factor out. Second, symplectic means that if you pull back the Gardner bracket along, under this diffeomorphism, you get the standard bracket in class standard symplectic coordinates. And the third remark, the same coordinate system works also for all higher KdV equations. So each Hamiltonian in the KdV hierarchy is put into standard integrable form by the one and the same diffeomorphism. You don't have to do any extra work to obtain that. Yeah?
Can you explain what you mean by Birkhoff coordinates versus action angle coordinates?
Yeah, because action angle really means action angles. I mean, if you have I and theta, you really have angular variables. But that's actually a bad idea if you want to do it nicely for the KdV equation, because, well, angulars, these angles always have singularities. But Birkhoff coordinate means, it comes from Birkhoff normal form, that is, you can really write it as xn squared plus yn squared, and in these coordinates you have no trouble going through zero and letting any of these coordinates become zero. I mean, if you're honest, I mean, the way how to construct these coordinates is by first defining actions by some integral, and then you have to introduce angles in a very tricky way, and then from these angle actions, which are defined only on a dense subset, not on an open domain, you define Birkhoff coordinates as just Cartesian coordinates as usually as they should be, and then of course you have to work a little bit to show that what you define this way really is analytic on an open domain. You don't run into any bad singularities or so. But finally, I mean, for the end result, to formulate it properly, I mean, the Birkhoff coordinates are much more straightforward, and you don't have to talk about any special points where the actions become zero. I mean, it's just a smooth thing in these type of coordinates.
Pardon?
Yeah. Yeah. So So maybe this term Birkhoff coordinate is not that standard yet, but I think it really makes sense to call them this way. Okay, so... Good. So, I mean, if you use these coordinates to describe KdV, of course everything is simple and it looks like standard integrable system, but now with infinitely many degrees of freedom. That is, every solution, every motion in the system takes place on an invariant torus, which now is an infinite product of circles with fixed radius in. And now if you have any circle with positive radius in this invariant torus. There you can introduce action angle coordinates in the usual way, and the equations of motion reduce to In dot equals zero and theta n dot equals to a constant frequency. The frequencies you can also describe in some detail, but they don't matter at all for what I'm talking about. So everything looks like standard finite dimensional integrable systems, more or less. So from that you can already conclude or extract the well-known standard result by now that KdV is well posted in Hn. I mean, from the theorem as it's stated so far, you already get the well posedness of KdV in Hn. Start with an initial value U0 in Hn0. Take the inverse coordinate system, so map it to its Birkhoff coordinates, call them Z0. Well, this extra weight, 1/2, comes from the symplectic structure arising from DDX. So you have to throw in one extra 1/2 exponent. So if you flow along the KdV flow in these Birkhoff coordinates, you're just moving along these circles. So the asymptotic behavior of the X and Y n remains the same because you're just changing phases, so to speak. So the KdV flow in these Birkhoff coordinates, called it little psi t, maps this onto psi t of Z0, and it is the same Sobolev sequence space Hn. And then you go back with capital psi to the flow point phi t of U0 in the same Sobolev space Hn. So this tells you right away that in the Sobolev spaces, KdV is well posed globally. And also, using this coordinate system and its analyticity, the dependence on initial values is no problem at all. Absolutely well behaved in that respect. So this is a classical result, and I mean, what I'm talking essentially about is now is to extend this to Jeffrey classes and maybe also these other Sobolev classes. And to do that, we now need some regularity results for these Jeffrey spaces, meaning I need results about looking at the Birkhoff coordinate map. Maybe I should use the other slide. I have to expand this result about the restriction of this coordinate system to the subspaces little hn or n plus 1/2. I have to extend this to the corresponding spaces with Jeffrey weights. So if I introduce the weights, that is 1 plus n to the power r, e to the an to the power sigma, then, and I define the sequence space with these weights, and I throw in this extra exponent 1/2, I indicate this with a subscript, and the weight itself is in the superscript. Then I have to use an extension of the theorem 2, which says that if I restrict this coordinate system to this Jeffrey subspaces of sequences, then it's again a one-to-one onto diffeomorphism from this sequence space to the corresponding Jeffrey space of functions U. No, this is both of us, let's say. Yeah, that's both of us. So if I have this extension to these subspaces, and not only to these subspaces, then it's an immediate corollary of the results of the reasoning I indicated on the other slide, that KdV is also well posed in HW if W is a Jeffrey weight. So I mean, with this same reasoning, I mean essentially conjugating the KdV flow to the corresponding trivial flow in the sequence space. So everything depends on proving this extension theorem 3 for Jeffrey spaces, and later also have an analog result for the Sobolev spaces. So how do you do that? This is also not a very big deal. So the elements of the proof of this theorem 3 are the following. You first need a characterization of these Jeffrey spaces HW by asymptotics of their spectral gaps of when you look at these functions as potentials of Hill's equation. So if U is in HW, you want to conclude that its spectral gaps are in the corresponding sequence space, little hw, and also vice versa. You have to be able to go in from one to the other or backwards. And then the second ingredient is to relate the spectral gaps, the gap length gamma n, to the asymptotic decay rate of the Birkhoff coordinates xn and yn. You need one fact about the actions of the KdV equation, which come pretty early in this book, KdV and Km with Thomas Kappeler, namely that if you define the actions In and look at the ratio In to the gamma n squared, then this is never equal to zero, and multiplied by n, this is approximately equal to one. Or you can rephrase this saying that the gap length squared is approximately equal to n times xn squared plus yn squared. That is the n times the action In. And this holds for the real space of real functions and the complex neighborhood of this. Okay, these are the two ingredients I need, and I will use them in the following way. And to do that, I now look at the inverse of the Birkhoff map, because that's, call it omega, because that's what the mapping functions U to their Birkhoff coordinates. So I now look at the map in the opposite direction and call it omega. So remember, the problem is to prove this theorem 3, namely that the map to Birkhoff coordinates respects also regularity in the Jeffrey classes. And this consists of two steps. So you look at this map, which goes from the potentials to the Birkhoff sequence of Birkhoff coordinates. So the first thing is to show that the map, if you look at it on the subspace HW, that this map is into the corresponding sequence space. So, and to do that, you need a theorem about spectral asymptotics. Let's call it theorem A. And this is a theorem which is due to Kappeler and Mityagin, telling you that if you take a potential of Hill's equation in this Jeffrey space HW, or even you can take any of the Sobolev, Abel, or Jeffrey weights, doesn't make any difference for this result. So it means that going from the function to the sequence, you preserve the regularity. So if U is in HW for any of these weights, then the sequence of spectral gaps is in the corresponding sequence space, little h of W. That's theorem A. And if you combine that information with the conclusion from this simple relation, that is, you can, at least in the real case, bound xn squared plus yn squared by gamma n squared, then you conclude that if U is in HW, then the Birkhoff coordinates decay at the same rate, which tells you that the map is into the corresponding sequence space. Now, this is true in the real case. If you need this, and gamma n and xn and yn are real, then this is a conclusion of this relation. In the complex case, xn squared need not be real anymore or positive. In the complex case, you have to do a little bit more. You have to replace gamma n by gamma n plus the distance of the dearest corresponding Dirichlet eigenvalue from the midpoint of the spectral gaps. Well, I don't want to go into the details here. Just let's restrict to the real case. If you have questions later, I can say more about that. But I just want to finish in time. So this settles the question of if you start at a function in the space HW, you certainly will end up in the corresponding sequence space, so the map is into. Now, naturally, the second question is the map also onto? And if that happens, you're done. So you want to know if the map, the same map, the global Birkhoff coordinate map, is also onto and you're restricted to these Jeffrey subspaces. So you would argue like, or you would try to reason as follows. You pick any point in the sequence space HWZ. That's a sequence of Birkhoff coordinates, Zn. It fits in the space HW 1/2. But of course, I'm considering subspaces of my big space H little w without any weights. And I know that the Birkhoff coordinate map on little L2, on big L2 is onto H 1/2. So considered as an element of H 1/2, I know that I can go back because the map is onto and find a potential U corresponding to this sequence. It exists. It's well defined. I mean, it's there. That's the basic result. So I have this and I just have to establish regularity of this potential U. And I again use this relation. I don't have it on the slide there, but reading it the other way, I now have the additional information that the gap lengths of this potential U, they are certainly bounded from above by a constant time root n times the square root of xn squared plus yn squared, the Birkhoff coordinates. And I was assuming that these Birkhoff coordinates are in the space HW 1/2. So from this reasoning, I conclude that I know that the corresponding spectral gaps of this potential U in L2 behave like a sequence in HW. So now I need another theorem, theorem B, the converse to theorem A, to speak, allowing me to go in the opposite direction. Having a potential in L2 and knowing that its spectral gaps decay at a certain rate, that should tell me that the potential is in the corresponding subspace of L2. I mean, as I said, I mean, spectral gaps should be considered more or less like Fourier coefficients. So if they decay at a certain rate, this should tell me, give me the regularity of the potential. But this is true only for Sobolev and Jeffrey weights and not for Abel-Sobolev weights. I'd say that, we'll talk about that a little bit later. So there we have to distinguish between these different type of weights. We have to take out the Abel-Sobolev weights. But for Sobolev and Jeffrey, this thing is absolutely correct. And so invoking this theorem, we can conclude that our map is also onto. So the restriction of the map, where was it? So that's the conclusion. So the restriction of this map to these subspaces, now either Jeffrey or Sobolev, is one-to-one and onto, and the inverse is, of course, then the inverse of the global map omega restricted to the corresponding sequence subspace. And we know that this is already also analytic. So from that, we conclude that the restricted map is real analytic and the real analytic diffeomorphisms, that is, looking at the inverse map is also analytic. And this establishes the main result for Jeffrey spaces and recovers the result for Sobolev spaces. So now I have to say something about the analytic case. So this theorem B, meaning going from sequences to the decay of the spectral gaps to the regularity of the potential U, is not true in the analytic category. And the simple example is the following. If you look at finite gap potential, that is, the sequence of gap length is zero from a certain point on. So there's only finitely many non-zero entries in your sequence. Then this sequence, of course, decays exponentially fast at any rate you wish. You can choose any A you like, arbitrarily large. So such a the sequence of gap length of a finite gap potential is in any sequence space H R A for any A greater than zero. But it's well known that the potential U may have poles. I mean, the Weierstrass P function has one gap open, and it has poles, so it's not an entire function. If there would be a one-to-one correspondence between these spaces and the corresponding space of analytic functions, you would conclude that it's the corresponding potential should be analytic in a strip of arbitrary width, so it should be an entire function, and this is simply not true. And so that's the simple reason why in the Abel-Sobolev class the result is not that clean. You have to make a certain provision for that. But you don't lose everything, and the theorem C, maybe that the theorem B for this special case, you can formulate like that. If the sequence gamma n is in some Abel-Sobolev sequence space, HRA, then the potential belonging to that is also analytic and belongs to some space HR alpha, where alpha is between 0 and A, and you can choose this alpha uniformly on bounded subsets of L2. So, yeah, and when you apply this to the KdV equation, and that's where I get my uniformity from. I mean, just very quickly, if you apply this to the KdV equation, you start with some U naught in HRA, analytic on a strip of width A. Then the image of this potential lies in the corresponding sequence space. Then the isospectral set, so call it ether of this image in HR, that means this torus belonging to that, is also in the same space, and it's bounded in L2. I mean, the corresponding set of potentials is bounded in L2. And from that, you can conclude with that result that all the potentials on that torus should be in a fixed space HR alpha, with fixed alpha. And you can even choose this alpha just depending on the ball, big ball, which where all these potentials lie in. So it applies also to all other isospectral sets in the same ball. Okay, so in that sense, you can loosely say that you have the Bell-Positiveness of the KdV equation in the spaces, in the Abel-Sobolev spaces HR alpha, if you allow for little loss in analyticity in the width I, and you can make this uniformly bounded on bounded subsets. So as I said, you can apply this also not only to the KdV equation, but it's useful for perturbed KdV equations. And actually, the whole thing goes back to a question of Moser in that context when results about perturbed KdV equation were found by you. And but this also applies that to analytic initial, certain analytic initial values. You start with an analytic initial value, you perturb the KdV equation in this analytic vector field, does the flow also consist of analytic functions? And this answers these questions, for example. Pardon? Yeah, well, in the way I've written it down here. Say, you look at the perturbed KdV equation, that means you add a perturbing Hamiltonian to it, call it K, and you assume that the vector field, the Hamiltonian vector field corresponding to K, lies, for example, in some Jeffrey space, has Jeffrey regularity. And since the KdV equation is now well posed in this space of Jeffrey function, we can study the perturbation problem entirely within the space of Jeffrey functions. And for that to work, you also need the corresponding KEM theorem to work within these spaces of Jeffrey weights. But this is really no big deal. I mean, if you look at the proof as we have written it down in the book, KdV and KEM, there it is written for functions which are analytic. So you use exponential weights e to the an to describe your functions. But the only property you use about these weights is that they are submultiplicative. So if you replace these weights by Jeffrey weights like this, the proof stays exactly the same. You don't have to change anything. So you can take this proof literally to prove the corresponding result of for KEM result for that works done in Jeffrey space instead of spaces of analytic. No, I mean the argument is like that. I mean, you have a perturbation which is in HW. So the result which I described so far allows you to restrict your investigation of the KdV equation also to HW. No. I mean, the precise result should. I don't say that every solution now of this perturbed equation stays in HW. It's a KM type result. There is a large subset and so on, and you could, that's what I mean. I mean, the rest may be a little bit more tricky, maybe even wrong. But no, I didn't write it down. But I mean, it's just a sketch. If you have to make the right formulation, then. At least you can say you find lots of solutions which stay in that space. So the only limiting factor, so to speak, is the regularity of the perturbation. And the rest can be adjusted to that regularity. And you stay in that class. So I have one more slide. And this is just about, I mean, what is the main technical ingredient? I mean, more or less it's all just hand waving and making some proper remarks. What it comes down to is are these theorems A, B, and C relating regularity to spectral asymptotics, or more precisely, asymptotics of spectral gaps. So this is about the Hills equation and its spectrum. And the question is, does the regularity of the potential U relate in a one-to-one fashion to the decay rate of the spectral gaps? Or, as I said, you can phrase the question like this. Behave the spectral gaps like the nth Fourier coefficient of the potential U? And, of course, this is also not a new question, and the first and breakthrough in this matter was due to Marchenko and Ostrovsky, their famous paper, where, among others, they showed that this is true for the standard Sobolev spaces. So if U, now here I write Q, but if Q is equal to U, if Q is in HM, then the sequence of gaps is in the corresponding sequence space, little hm. Then the next two main results in that direction were due to Hochstadt and Trubowitz. Hochstadt said, showed that if Q is C infinity, then the gap lengths decay at any polynomial rate, and vice versa. And Trubowitz proved the same for the analytic category. If Q is analytic, then the gap lengths decay exponentially fast. And in the other way, a direction, if they decay exponentially fast, the potential must be analytic. Well, and recently this question was then extended to the setting of Jeffrey spaces, which became rather popular in the last 10, 15 years. And these results were extended to these Jeffrey spaces and other weights by Kapler and Mityagin in this one direction, and in the opposite direction by a paper by Diakov and Mityagin. Now, if you look at these papers, you really see that the whole thing is a complete mess. I mean, it's horrible estimates and, well, in some sense, you don't quite know what they're doing. And that's actually where the fun part now, where the talk really should start. And I spent the last couple of months thinking about this proof, and I found a very easy way of proving this without any messy estimates, but just reducing it to the implicit function theorem. But that would be a different talk altogether. So I think I just stop here. So.